Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the network. And when I have the time, I try to do an interview about an interesting book. Well, most of the time, I manage the hosts, many hosts on the network who do our interviews. I hope you listen to them. And when I saw Dreamland by Sam Quinones cross my desk, I said to myself, I really have to talk to this fellow. Well, anyway, Sam, thank you for writing the book, and thank you for being on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot, Marshall.
Absolutely. So could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm a reporter, an author, journalist. I've been doing this profession for close to 30 years now. Dreamland is my third book. I grew up in California, went to UC Berkeley. I worked as a crime reporter, which was one of the first jobs in my life, in Stockton, California, which was one of the formative jobs, almost like grad school, you could say, for me. I then, spent 10 years living in Mexico as a reporter, as a freelance writer, writing for all manner of magazines and newspapers. And that was a hugely important part of my life. And out of that, I wrote my first two books, which are true tales, true stories about Mexico. The first one was about Mexico. It's called True Tales from Another Mexico, The Lynch Mob, The Popsicle Kings, Chelino, and The Bronx. And that was about Mexico, stories from Mexico, particularly Mexico on the margins. And the second book was called Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream, True Tales of Mexican Migration. And that was, again, all about Mexican immigrants, both in the United States and when they also return to Mexico, where their impact is huge. I worked for 10 years after coming back from Mexico. I worked for 10 years with the Los Angeles Times and resigned there in 2014. And I'm once again, very happily, a freelance writer. And that brings us up to the present, I think.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that. Could you please tell us why you wrote Dreamland?
Well, what happened was, I think for most people, most people in America kind of get into this story, understand this story, have contact with this story first through prescription pain pills. That's their first contact, that something's awry. There's an addiction in the family, or police officers are dealing with pill mills or what have you, the renegade doctors or people using these pills, abusing these pills, this kind of thing. My experience was quite the opposite. My experience first was I was on a team of reporters for the LA Times writing about the Mexican drug war. My focus was really on Mexico. And as part of that, I began to realize that heroin traffickers from Mexico were doing all of a sudden a real banner business. And I didn't understand why on earth that could possibly be. I thought heroin was this old style drug that no one used anymore, or very few people used. It was not really a big deal. And so why would the seizures be rising every year at the border and, you know, this kind of thing. And so I kind of backed into this story. I found this story in Huntington, West Virginia, of a whole spate of heroin overdoses in West Virginia. This was a state I did not associate with heroin at all. And what's more, it was to black tar heroin. And I didn't understand how that could be either, because I know that black tar heroin, I knew this many years now, that black tar heroin in this hemisphere is only made in Mexico. And black tar heroin for many years, it was still the case, I thought, never crossed the Mississippi River. It's really more of a Western U.S. drug. And so how could it be in Huntington, West Virginia, in quantities large enough to create massive overdoses? This was really the first big spate of overdoses, concentrated overdoses with people dying that you found growing out of this story in Huntington, West Virginia. Didn't make any sense. And so I followed that up. That led me to a very large story about this one town in Mexico, a very small town in the state of Nayarit, where everyone in that town who comes to the United States, most everyone, sells heroin. And they sell heroin in a very distinctive way, which is like pizza, a kind of a delivery system for heroin. And unlike most heroin traffickers, they are they're very schooled, they have a system, and they have spread, they have expanded. So they started in the Southern California, the San Fernando Valley area of LA, and they in the 80s and by the early 90s they were spreading throughout the Western United States, and the late 90s they made it east of the Mississippi River, and by the early to mid 2000s they were really ensconced in Columbus and in Nashville and Charlotte, Indianapolis, various towns like that, and the deaths that I discovered in Huntington all had to do with their heroin that addicts from Huntington were driving to Columbus, Ohio to buy and then take home, and the dope was so potent that it was really not they weren't able to withstand it, and a lot of them died. Now So that was the story I got very, very into for a couple of years. I wrote a big piece, a series of stories for the LA Times about it, and then began to think, damn, this is a bigger story. But the thing that really hit me was it still didn't answer my question of why they would have a market for heroin in West Virginia in the first place. Again, it was not a state that I associated with heroin at all. I associated heroin with the big cities, you know, Chicago, LA, New York, et cetera, that kind of thing. And so it was only then that I began to realize that as big as that story was, there was a much, much bigger story in how demand for heroin was created in the first place. And that got me into the enormous story of the change in American medicine with regard to pain management and the promotion, the aggressive prescribing of pain pills, Vicodin, opiates like Vicodin, OxyContin, Percocet, and others that people may know. And so I really backed in to this story, but as I backed into it, I began to realize, gee, this the Mexican story is big, but then I realized, dang, the pill story is much, much bigger. The heroin traffickers come second to this story, and it's when I realized that I began to think, dang, this is a book I need to write. It's a national story. I thought it was like a regional thing, you know, Columbus, Appalachia, and then I realized no, this is all over the country, and this heroin is going to break big. At the time, heroin was not the big deal that it's become in the last couple year and a half or so. The pill thing was still much bigger, but I began to feel like everywhere there are pills, people are going to be transitioning to heroin, and that's what we're seeing. And that was the hunch I had that pushed me to write the book.
It's interesting because I've seen some of this, glimpsed it, kind of out of the corner of my eye for much of my life. And So, for example, I think you and I were probably living in Berkeley at roughly the same time, and I saw a lot of people do a lot of drugs, and I think I did a lot of drugs too, to be honest with you. I never did heroin, nor did I ever meet anyone who did.
Right.
It was just one of those things that people used to do. I heard about that. I heard about it in a Velvet Underground song. That was the best I could do.
Yes.
But I didn't know anyone who did it. I didn't know how to get it.
Well, I think what happened, though, was in that period of time, we were going through a change that this was the 1980s. A big part of this story is that in the 1980s, our heroin market in the United States radically changed. Up to that point, for decades, and especially in the 1970s with the big increase in heroin use in the late 60s and the 1970s, a lot of our heroin came from the Far East. It came from Burma, Thailand, Vietnam, wherever, those kind of Afghanistan, maybe those kinds of countries. Turkey, of course, the French Connection case was built on heroin from Turkey. But in the 1980s, what ends up happening is the Far East heroin gets outcompeted by heroin coming up from Latin America much closer. Heroin is a commodity. It differs only in how much it's been diluted or cut. And so a lot of the price of heroin is dependent on how far it has to travel. And if it's coming up from Mexico and Colombia, which was the two countries where it was principally made and where it's been principally made in our hemisphere, it very easily outcompetes and underprices the heroin coming from 12,000, 15,000 miles away, whatever it happens to be. And so that meant that our country essentially divided at the Mississippi River. West of the United, west of the Mississippi was essentially Mexican heroin, black tar mostly. East of the Mississippi was essentially Colombian heroin. But the case was that it was far cheaper than ever before. The thing was, though, nobody noticed that because, as you say, in those years, a lot of people were just people weren't really using heroin. It was other drugs that were far more popular. Crack, of course, being a big one. Mm-hmm. Then later methamphetamine, always marijuana, of course. But heroin was just like, no one really noticed this. This becomes only important when in the late 1990s, this pain revolution in American medicine takes place and takes hold, and a huge, huge, massive new supply of opiate pain pills is unleashed on the country. And then all of a sudden, cheap heroin is a huge issue because people get addicted to these pills and develop enormous tolerances to it. So they're using 200-300 milligrams a day of this stuff, and they can't sustain it because on the street the pills are going for $1 a milligram. So that's, you know, you're spending 100, 200, 300 bucks a day on this. You just can't sustain that. Mm-hmm. So you look around for a much cheaper but equivalent alternative. And of course, heroin and these pills are all derivative of the opium poppy. They're all chemically very, very similar. They're narcotics, all of them, and they're all great painkillers. And this creates a situation in which people are paying $200-300 bucks a day looking for a cheap alternative. And all of a sudden, that switch in the 1980s becomes hugely relevant because Mexico and Colombia are providing the very cheap heroin. And so people begin to switch. And one of the first places we're seeing that all across the country today, right now, that's the story in many, many communities in every state of this country, I believe. But back then in the mid 2000s, one of the first places you saw that was in Huntington, West Virginia, where pill addicts were switching to much cheaper heroin. And then, of course, a lot of them were dying because the heroin was not only cheaper, it's far more potent, because it doesn't travel as far, isn't change hands, isn't cut as much. And so people were dying. And that's kind of what we're seeing today, again, in many, many parts of the country. But the first or among the first cases of this was the one I wrote about in Dreamland in Huntington, West Virginia.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, so just to go back to your and my story. So we're in Berkeley in the 80s, and I won't speak for you, but I was doing drugs, but none of the really popular ones were heroin. So it existed kind of only in my mind, and that was true for a long time. Until I think it was around 2002, and I was living in Boston at the time, and there were all these reports of these whacked out junkies breaking into pharmacies trying to steal pills called OxyContin. I don't know if you remember this, but it was like the Wild West. I mean, they were breaking into these places with guns, and all they wanted was this one thing. They didn't want phenobarbital. They didn't want, you know, cocaine. They didn't want anything. They wanted this one thing, OxyContin. I didn't even know what that was. I didn't even know it was an opiate.
Right.
But it was driving, in the press, it was driving them wild. It was driving them to crime. So this really
and OxyContin is the game changer. That's what creates this whole problem that we're dealing with today. And it's important to understand how that is or how that could be.
Yeah.
First of all, it's important, you know, before OxyContin, the opiate narcotic painkillers that were out there were all combined with acetaminophen or Tylenol as abuse deterrent, so that you couldn't really do a lot, use a lot of these pills without doing great damage to your innards, to your liver and kidney and what have you. And so these are pills like Lortab, Percocet, Vicodin. They all had some abuse deterrent in them. And so people would mess around with them, maybe even get addicted to them, but never make that switch to heroin. And never be able to develop enormous tolerances, because by then it would turn their insides to goo, you know. Mm-hmm. Just it would just destroy a person's innards, kind of. And so that was the case for many years, because those pills have been around for a long time, and people really didn't switch to heroin off of bike. Some did, but it was not like large numbers, you know. So what ends up happening is 1996. Purdue Pharma, a Connecticut-based pharmaceutical company, comes out with OxyContin. And OxyContin is fundamentally different from those narcotic painkillers of the past in that it has no abuse deterrent. Has no Tylenol, no acetaminophen. In fact, the point of OxyContin is it's oxycodone continuous. That's how you get the word OxyContin. It's a time-release pill that is coated with a time-release formula that Purdue developed. And the idea is that this will kind of leak a painkiller into your body over a 12-hour period, and you will have substantial pain relief without having to take a pill every 2 hours, as was the case with the other pills. If you're in pain, you had to take a pill every 2-3 hours, every 6 hours, whatever happens to be. With OxyContin, you take one in the morning, one in the evening, and supposedly you're fine. But in order to do that, they had to include a lot of painkiller in each pill. First was 40 milligrams, then 80 milligrams for a while, though they discontinued it. There was 160 milligrams. And so you had a lot of dope in one pill with no abuse deterrent in it. And what ends up happening is people start getting addicted. Some people, it's due to just simple recreational drug. They're drug abusers or what have you. They find it on the street or they find it at a party. Others get addicted from using it exactly as doctors prescribe. But whatever the case, they begin to abuse it, suck off that time release formula, and just use the drug, smoke it, swallow it or smoke it. Eventually, they may be snorting it, and finally, as their tolerance rises. OxyContin has the effect. The crucial thing about OxyContin is it has the effect, because it's pure dope. There's no abuse deterrent, of increasing people's tolerances steadily, very quickly. Over a period of 6 months, you could rise from 80 milligrams, say, a day to 300. And that's a very, very expensive habit to form. Plus, the important thing is here, OxyContin, particularly in those years, in the late 90s and for most of the first decade of the century, was in huge supply all across the country. You could find it in many, many places in the black market, because doctors were prescribing it so aggressively, and pill mills then were starting up, where people would just routinely prescribe things without any pain diagnosis for their patients. And so you had this huge, huge supply, which was what allowed a lot of people to get addicted. This is a supply story more than anything else, not a demand story. It starts with supply. And so people would develop these enormous tolerances that they could not very easily wean off of, and they needed something else. And so it became, in the words of several addicts I talked to, a quote, no-brainer to then switch to heroin. It was financially a much better decision, although it was a catastrophic decision as well, because it was a whole lot more difficult to kick heroin for a lot of these folks. They switched to heroin. But OxyContin is the reason we have a heroin addiction problem in America, growing heroin addiction problem in America today, because nobody else before was going to develop the tolerance that would have pushed someone to then switch to heroin from the pills. And nothing else would have done that except OxyContin.
Mm-hmm. So I want to talk a little bit about the role of the pharmaceutical industry and doctors for a second, and I'll give another anecdote. Where I kind of ran into this. I ran into things in your books in my own right. So in about 1994-3, I think, I hurt my back very badly playing basketball. And I had all kinds of tests done on it, and MRIs and CAT scans and things like this. And I was in a lot of pain. And, you know, I asked the doctors about pain medication. And this was in Boston again. And they said that I should take a lot of Advil. That's all they had for me. They're like, sorry, we got nothing else for you. But there are these other things, right? They're like, yeah, there are, but we're not going to give them to you. You're going to take a lot of Advil. You're going to take like 10 a day.
Yeah.
That's what you're going to do. And I'm like, really? That's all you have? They're like, yep, that's all we're going to give you. Those doctors were acting responsibly, I think, right? I guess they were. I don't know. It helped, I guess. But then I think one of the things you say in the book is that by the late 90s, they would have had a different answer for me.
Yes, right. And this is, as I said, the crucial change that that created this problem today. And that was that, as you say, as you noted, when you went to, for many years, for decades, doctors would not prescribe opiate narcotics except for the most extreme examples of dying of terminal cancer patients, you know, where the most extreme pain. It was very rare. In a lot of hospitals, you had to get two or three signatures to sign off on using these drugs. Nobody would ever send patients home with bottles of the stuff. But in the mid-1990s, there was a revolution, really, in pain management in the United States. It actually began in the 80s, but it got revving, you could say, in the 1990s. And this held certain things. First of all, it was pushed at first by pain specialists. And these were young doctors, I think, who had come into medicine and been seared, I believe, by the experience of watching people beg for pain relief, particularly in palliative care, hospice care, dying patients, that kind of thing, beg for relief and not get it, even though the pills were right there. And I think as a young doctor, if you see this and you get into medicine to help people and assuage pain, relieve pain, to watch this kind of affects you. And I think my best feeling is that a lot of these pain specialists early on were affected in this way. Like they thought this is so wrong.
If I could just jump in there, one of my best friends from Berkeley, who then became an anesthesiologist, I think he began practicing in the late, it must have been the late 80s, early 90s. I think he was one of these people because he founded a pain. He started pain management. I think he had seen.
What's his name?
Well, I don't want to give you his name, but I'm happy to give you his name off air if you want to talk to him. But anyway, he told me, he said, you know, I've seen these people in pain. I know what to do. I can stop this.
Yeah.
I've just been in medical school. They've taught me about how to fix this and I can't do it. They won't let me do it. And then later he went on into pain management.
Exactly. I think that experience for young doctors is extraordinarily impactful. I mean, it sears you and it makes you remember that, you know, you don't forget that. Mm-hmm. And so these guys developed, I believe, almost a religious fervor or a revolutionary fervor with regard to narcotic pain pills that they really wanted, because they had to push so hard against the conventional wisdom, which was to say, don't ever use these ever. They had to push so hard against that that they didn't stop pushing hard, you might say. And so they kept on and they won. I would say it didn't take long to win the argument that these pills should be used for dying cancer patients, because after all, if a person's addicted the last 3 months of his life, is that really important? What's more important is to allow the person to live the last 3 months of his life in dignity, relatively pain-free. But the thing is, I think once they started pushing, they didn't stop. And they kept pushing to say, this is really, really important to use for all manner of pain. We have a lot of people in chronic pain. We needed to use it for them. And there grew up a kind of a revolutionary fervor to change this kind of attitude in medicine. It was then, of course, helped by pharmaceutical companies who were then developing drugs, pills like OxyContin, that they wanted to promote. And they saw this as, in the past, they had marketed these kinds of pills only to dying cancer patients. Now they saw a much, much larger market in people who had chronic pain, people who had acute pain, you know, 3 or 4 days out of surgery. And, you know, the truth is that these pills do work very well for certain kinds of pain. The problem was the pendulum began to swing from never using it ever to, and it didn't stop. It didn't stop in a happy medium, in a happy middle somewhere. It kept on going to the point where it was, use these pills for every kind of pain. Use these pills. And the idea grew up that was extraordinarily important in all this, that these pills were virtually non-addictive when used to treat pain. That was the assumption that all of basically American medicine was operating on by the late 1990s, early 2000s, that these pills could be used and they would not addict a pain patient. Now, that proved to be extraordinarily incorrect and false. They had no proof that that was the case when they began pushing this idea. But whatever the case, they were able to convince an entire generation, two generations, basically, of doctors almost was convinced of this, that this was true. And so they began to not just prescribe these pills after, say, an acute a surgery, which is really when you should prescribe them. They're great for like the 3 days after you've been cut open, when the 3 to 5 days when the pain is acute and you want that pain. They began to say, what does it matter how many pills we prescribe after that if they're virtually non-addictive? And so instead of prescribing somebody, say, 6 Vicodin or 10 Vicodin after an appendix operation, for example, or a wisdom tooth extraction, they would prescribe 60 or 90. Mm-hmm. And all of this, this began to happen all over the country. That's the important thing here, that doctors everywhere in America bought into this idea in a way that is not true, say, in Europe, for example, mm-hmm. Or in Mexico, or in Canada so much. They bought into this idea, and that created an enormous supply of pills that were just kind of sloshing around the country. And a lot of that was diverted into the black market. A lot of those people, in fact, did get addicted. A lot of those pills later made it to parties and various places. But that became the way we treated pain, almost to the exclusion of almost anything else. That became the way we treated pain. And your friend's example, your friend's story, is the story of a lot of guys who grew up into medicine in the 1980s. And I think what's happened now is we've seen the collateral damage, which is nightmarish and is nationwide, from that idea. And a lot of people are really retreating from that position. But I would say it's been a relatively recent thing. Only in the last year or two have people really begun to understand the consequences of that revolution in pain management and medicine here.
Mm-hmm. And let me make clear that my friend is super smart and the biggest do-gooder you could ever meet. And,
they all are.
I mean, you really wanted to help.
There's nobody in this story is a dummy. Yeah. Nobody in this. That's the thing. The thing is, everybody in this story is extraordinarily smart. There are a few. I'm talking about the pain specialists now. Yeah. There, of course, in modern medicine, there's a certain number of quacks who get into this, and of course, they start these pill mills and stuff. But the guys who start this stuff are not devious, evil people.
No,
they are people who think they're doing the right thing. It just turns out that on a mass scale, it has, as I say, nightmarish collateral damage.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about pill mills for a second, because I knew a little bit about them. The first time I encountered them was actually in 12-step meetings in the early 2000s, early to mid 2000s, and this was the first time I met people who were addicts who weren't heroin addicts, basically. They were pill addicts,
yeah. Right?
And I did not understand that when I first heard it. I met a girl, I won't tell you her name as well, and she's like, yeah, I'd never bought any street drugs. I didn't do any of that crap. Are you kidding me? I'm a respectable person. And she said, right. Pills are my thing. You know, I would go to the doctor and I'd get pills because I had chronic pain or whatever. It was with a wink and a nudge that she had chronic pain, but maybe you could talk a little bit about those pill mills.
Sure. And what ends up happening, the extreme consequences of the pill revolution in modern American medicine is the pill mill. Well, really, it's the pain clinic. Now, the pain clinic, people set up pain clinics to deal specifically with people's pain. Now, a lot of these pain clinics start out at legit. And some of them stay legit. And so the doctor really is serious about diagnosing you, MRIs, maybe a lot of ways of trying to figure out what your pain problem is. Frequently, though, or perhaps I'm not sure frequently, but many times you find that doctors end up in a pain management clinic ends up being a pill mill. I asked a cop one time, what's the difference between a pain clinic and a pill mill? Well, pain clinic, pill mill, he said, offers almost no diagnosis. You come in, what's your problem? I got this pain in my back. Okay, here, boom, you're on your way. I got this pain in my neck. Okay, you're on your way. And in some cases, of course, they were one guy in particular in Eastern Kentucky was actually he just had mimeographed, Xeroxed off a bunch of the same prescription, and certain amount of OxyContin, certain amount of Xanax, certain amount of Vicodin. I can't remember what all it was, but he had stacks of the same prescription. He would give them to people as they came in. And what happened in modern medicine was these pills were viewed as a boon to doctors, pain doctors in particular. They end up really being a curse because you cannot get these pills prescribed to you over the phone. You have to go in to a clinic. You have to, so a lot of doctors saw this as a way of keeping their waiting rooms packed, and they began to accept only cash, no insurance, and so it became a cash cow. So people every month would go into the doctor's office and pay $250 and get a prescription, and that prescription they would then take to a pharmacy and get it filled. And those prescriptions included huge numbers of pills, 120 Vicodin, 120 OxyContin, a bunch of Xanax, on and on like that. And you could end up using a lot of that, but then also selling a lot of that on the street. The difference, the cop told me also, is a pill mill will have long lines outside. They'll have people getting pizza delivered in line because they don't want to lose their place. They come in, they have no care for what they look like. So a lot of people come in their pajamas.
Right.
Occasionally you'll see that. There'll be fist fights in line, and you'll see usually an average of about 90 seconds to 3 minutes per customer, per patient. Let's call them customer, but patient, supposedly. Mm-hmm. And these began to sprout up in various places across the country. The place that I talk about where the pill mill was really invented, the place where there was the capital of the pill mill, where this business model was invented, was the town of Portsmouth, Ohio, on the Ohio River, across the river from Kentucky. I got one doctor invented this in the late 90s using OxyContin, really, and then Vicodin and Percocet as his staple. And other doctors, he had an accident and couldn't practice a car accident, couldn't practice medicine, supposedly. He begins to hire other doctors who he brings in from across the country. A lot of these doctors have drug and alcohol addiction issues themselves. They're kind of almost on the point of losing their licenses. This is like a boon to them. And they learn the business. And a lot of those guys go out and start their own clinic, seeing what a big business it is. They leave him and go out. And so the business model by 1998, 1999, 2000 is really spreading throughout that area. And then, of course, as a business model, it spreads throughout the country. The reason, though, this turned out to be a curse is you think that a pill like this would, okay, it's great, I'm able to take care of my patient's pain finally. What it eventually does, though, to many, many doctors is that it destroys their kind of ethical compass. They begin to just rely on these pills and rely on these pills far, far too much, and they encounter daily very aggressive, very, very insistent patients demanding these pills. And a period of time, they just kind of break down. A lot of people just lose the scruples or the ethical compass that once guided them, and they become corrupted themselves, and they become part of the problem because some of these pill mills are prescribing millions of pills a year. You know, it's just a remarkable amount of pills that these guys do. However, I would say this about the pill mill. Pill mills are not why we have this problem today. There were never enough pill mills in America to create the problem that we have today. The problem was really created because a whole bunch nationwide, an entire generation or two of doctors nationwide accepted the idea that this was the way to treat pain and could be done so at virtually no risk of addicting your patient. The entire medical community of America basically is why we have this problem. It is not a few bad apples that created the problem, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, my experience with my very, very good friend, who I admire very, very much, and who has done the world a lot of good, is completely consistent with that. Completely consistent.
Yeah.
And I would also say that in preparation for this interview, I asked some people who know a little bit about this industry. Apparently, the FDA has gotten down on doctors now, and that I asked somebody, I said, if I went to a doctor now and I said that I had tremendous, you know, my knees really bothered me, doc, give me some Vicodin or some OxyContin, the doctor would laugh a little bit and say, here's some acetaminophen for you.
And
that,
right.
That I would not get that stuff. You could take a massage. That might be good. Acupuncture is supposed to work. But I think that anymore, if she's correct, that...
Well, here the thing is, though, that with pain management, I think what people are returning to, what got eclipsed by the opiate pain pill was this more holistic approach to pain management. It was opiates are part of it, but not a big part. And so doctors are returning to the idea that a variety of strategies on one patient, particularly for chronic pain, is the way to go. The problem with that is, and this is the reason why the opiates were so appealing, is that it's very difficult for an American patient in modern America today to buy into the idea that you need to, it involves a lot of wellness choices. You know, you need to eat better. You need to stop smoking, stop drinking sodas. You need to eat fewer, get up off the couch. You need to exercise above all is one of the most important things you can do to keep yourself from this problem or to assuage a problem. Acupuncture is part of the issue. Sometimes job and marital counseling can be part of the approach. I mean, there's a whole panoply. That's the problem.
Right.
The pain is really a difficult thing to treat. It is not something we would treat it with one approach for everybody, pills for everybody. And the truth is that it's just not that easy. And life is not that simple. Life is complicated. And we learned that with this. But because doctors were encountering patients in America who did not want to buy into the idea that they needed to walk more and stop drinking Coca-Cola and cut down on a lot of other things that they were doing. Because of that, they really needed felt that they needed another simpler solution, and the pills were that solution. And
right.
Of course, the problem is that it created a whole bunch of other problems that no one was considering.
It reminds me a little bit of what they say in AA, and that is that in order for this program to work, you just have to stop drinking and change your entire life.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
Right.
Just stop drinking.
Right.
Change
right.
your
That's,
entire life.
And with pain management, that frequently is the approach.
Yeah.
The thing is this, though. We want simplicity. We want easy answers. And sometimes life doesn't provide them.
No.
That's, you know, since I've written this book, I've been like, gotten into a whole new exercise regimen where I'm swimming every day. Seriously.
I mean, that's what it gets back to.
It's individual accountability,
right.
You know, individual discipline. You got to do it. And it seems to me that is, that we all need to do that.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I guess I want to go back we're almost out of time, but again, kind of in preparation for this interview, I talked to somebody I know who knows a lot about these things. And what she said to me was, you know, she had read your book, actually, and she said, yeah, he's right. I lived through this. He's right about the black tar heroin, and he's right about the doctors, and he's right about the pill mills,
yes.
And all that is totally correct. The explanation is correct. But the tragedy, in addition to the fact that a lot of people are dying from heroin overdoses, is that pain still isn't very well managed. And it may even be the case that these drugs are still underprescribed because we're afraid of them again. And that the people who need them aren't getting them.
There is, we have trouble finding that happy medium, you know, as a country. Maybe that's just human nature. I suspect it may be just human nature. I don't know. But yes. There is a role for these pills in pain management. You're never going to hear me say, gee, we should ban them. Or we should just stop prescribing them. Why is that better than over-prescribing? It wasn't. It wasn't. Back in the days when they didn't prescribe this for or use these pills at all, that people were in indecent, horrifying pain. That's not good. That's not good either. No, so there has to be a happy medium that where pills are used, particularly pills are used to get people up and going on other strategies for pain management. It may be you could say, well, you should go swim. Well, I can't even get out of my chair. How am I going to swim? You know? So maybe the pain management approach is to use pills to get you up and moving a little bit and then get you into other strategies. I was speaking with a guy from a pain sufferer, a guy who's formed his own foundation, and he was saying none of us wanted only, we did not want only pain pills. That was not what we ever wanted. We just wanted a balanced approach, but you cannot have a balanced approach without these pills being part of the picture. The problem is they cannot be the majority of the picture. They cannot be most of it. But there is a role for them. And right. I buy that. That makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense in that, you know, maybe these are this way of saying of getting people up and moving. And then once they're up and moving, they can try other things. Those other things are just as important. And if you're not going to use them, then they're not going to have the effect that you're not going to control the pain. But it's also true that pain is almost like a subjective thing. It's every individual has a different pain problem and a different pain solution. And that's why we ran into huge problems with one, using one pill mm-hmm. for the whole, for everybody in the country.
Mm-hmm. Well, what you said really means very much with me. And again, it goes back to this quip that people in AA will sometimes say, you have to stop drinking and change your whole life. Because really, I mean, I've been in the program for many years now, and I can tell you that not drinking in this case or not using is the prerequisite for getting the benefits of the program. The stop sure. drinking and stop using isn't going to do you any good at all. You're still going to be a kind of a mess. It's all that other stuff that you have to do, which is really uncomfortable and hard. I have to tell
yeah.
you, it's not any fun at all. I mean, later today, I'm going to go visit a bunch of my friends. I have to do this a lot, you know, take an hour out of my day. And I have to go to these people and talk to them. And they're great. I love them. But, you know, I kind of wish I was a normie sometimes and I didn't have to do that. But that's really the price of me being sane as an addict. And so,
yeah.
you know, that's what I have to do. You have to go swimming. I have to go talk to these people.
Right. And you know, I think part of the story really coincides with our own prosperity as a country. We kind of won the Cold War, you know, and mm-hmm. we began to think that there was no real, we wanted simplicity at that when simple things. We didn't want to be bothered with the complexities of the world or of life. We also, I think a big part of this story is that we were very, very, we still are. We had grown extraordinarily isolated from each other
mm-hmm.
In many, many ways, in poor communities and wealthy communities, the same. There was an isolation. And of course, opiates and heroin in particular are the most isolating of drugs. Right. I mean, the heroin addict wants nothing more than to spend all his time alone or with his dope buddies in a small room or something. No one wants to kind of interact.
Mm-hmm.
We had built up a kind of an idea that path to happiness was buying lots and lots of stuff.
Right.
And heroin is the final stuff, right? That'll take away all your pain, make you happy, remove the complexity of life. To me, a lot of what this story became about, I'm a crime reporter and initially, I thought I was writing a crime book, a drug book or something like that. And it turned into more a story about what we become as a country, what American had become and Americans, what we have become. And it's very isolated, very isolated by technology, isolated by suburban development, isolated by fear of the outside, fear of the public. Nobody goes outside in the streets anymore. Kids don't play in the streets as much anymore. All that kind of stuff. We raised a whole population of kids to fear pain above all else. When in fact, mm-hmm. pain is actually a good thing for in some measure. For development of a person, you need pain. You need to learn from pain, of pain of all kinds. Mm-hmm. And we had gotten away from that. It seems to me we you know, so we have a whole generation of kids grown to fear pain, fear discomfort, fear maybe even hard work, difficulty above all things. And heroin seemed to and these opiates seem to be like the perfect antidote to all of that, to pain, to difficulty, to discomfort. And that's one, I think it gets into a much larger story of who we become as Americans, that this story does. It seemed to me as I was writing it that there were bigger issues involved besides simply whether or not the doctor down the street was prescribing too many pills. That's certainly, of course, essential to the story. I'm just saying that there's a deeper part to this that's very important in understanding how we got to where we are today.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're exactly right about that. I mean, I've thought a lot about these things, honestly. And, you know, I know that for many years of my own life, I pinned my hope on success of various kinds and maybe getting things, although things really weren't my thing. But certainly the approbation of my peers was important to me, and I got that. And,
sure.
You know, you get a little bit maybe this is just maturity. You get a little bit later in life, and you're just you realize that your suffering just doesn't have anything to do with what's around you. It's all in your head. And really what you need to do is fix your head somehow. And Americans don't know how to do that. I think Buddhists know how to do that, but I don't. I'm sorry, it's a Lutheran. We have no idea.
That's one of the reasons I suggest in the afterword is that people need to, you know, be more out in the open, be in public a lot more, be around your neighbors, create that community. This is a story I often say in my talks about isolation versus community. The drug thrives in isolation when people are isolated, when communities are fragmented. The way to defeat it is in community in a variety of ways, bringing together people who, for example, cops, public health, PTA, Kiwanis and Chamber of Commerce, the local doctors, maybe the EMS folks, and bringing them together and discussing how do we address this problem. It's in community. It's a variety of approaches. It's the same with pain. How do you address pain properly? It seems to me that the proper way to do this is a community of responses, not one thing for everybody.
Yeah.
The unitary kind of solitary approach to it all. To me, a drug that isolates and thrives in our own isolation is defeated or combated via community.
Yeah.
And that's the problem, that in many areas, as I said, people do not form, they live in the same place, but you can't call it a community.
Right.
You can't call it a place where people know each other and spend time outside talking to one another, kids playing outside, all that kind of stuff. Everyone's isolated. No one knows each other.
Mm-hmm.
And in that situation, we've had this problem. One of the biggest reasons why this problem spread was because parents, upon having a child who was addicted or then die of overdoses, would not share this with the community. They were terrified. They were ashamed. They were embarrassed. They would sit alone in their room crying, their arms around a photo album, and fearing more than anything, in this searing grief that they felt, they feared more than anything that other people would find out how their kid really died, that he did not die of a heart attack, or the obituary would say died suddenly, you know, while 25 years old, how do you die suddenly?
Yeah.
You know, and so it was really this kind of, the parents were isolated too. Everybody was isolated, and that's how this thing spread and thrived is because of our own isolation as Americans.
Again, I think everything useful in life, I think I learned in a 12-step program, because one of the things they always tell you is don't isolate. You're isolating. I see you doing that.
Yeah, right, right.
I didn't know I was isolating until someone told me.
You need that community, and that's what kind of AA and other groups also provide. That's what churches provide.
Yeah, sure,
these kinds of things are, it's really, really important. But it's also important early on, I think, for parents early on when kids are young to not give them everything, to say no, to make them work hard for things, not give them approval for having achieved almost nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Really, it's like you get kids growing up afraid more than anything of hard work, of discipline, of pain, of discomfort of any kind, of complexity. All these things are, I think, part of how kids get involved in these drugs. It really is really important, I think, to raise kids to say, no, you can't have that.
Yeah,
you have to work. You have to work for that. I'm not going to buy your cell phone for you. You're going to work and buy it yourself.
Yeah, I grew up in the Midwest and I spent most of my life there. And I can tell you that here in the Northeast, they have a solution for a lot of that. It's called youth hockey.
There you go.
All my kids
there
are
you
playing
go.
Hockey. I don't have to skate.
See, it seems to me that sports are also, I have to say this, sports are also a way that used to create community and now do not. Sports nowadays, if you get your kids involved in youth sports very quickly, if they're going to come, you have to get them into club sports.
Yeah.
And club sports involve huge amounts of capital, money spent
on,
and then travel to all over. It's not your playing locally against kids you go to school with. You're traveling to, you know, sometimes by plane even to towns far away from you. And it's taken away the community aspect of youth sports, this club idea where, and every weekend, I know people in my community, every weekend, they're traveling 50 to 100 miles by car, staying in a community overnight to play sports tournaments in those community. And that's what the whole family does.
Yeah.
You have kids who are growing up on fields watching their siblings play because the whole family kind of goes to these things. And it seems to me, I know several parents like this or several families like this. It seems to me that that's breaking away from the role of youth sports, which is should be community based. But the problem is also, if you want your kid to be able to compete at high school soccer, your kid has to be in these club sports by certainly by middle school, probably by the end of elementary school. And to me, that's another way in which we have destroyed the community building properties of certain activities, and sports is one of them.
Yeah, I could go on with you talking about this forever. Maybe we will a little bit later, but I promised I would give you, I'd cut this thing off, give you time to talk about your most recent book, which is very relevant to what's going on today. So please, could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, there's there's two things. My second book was about immigration from Mexico. That was a book I was writing, and that was really that book really kind of pushed me into understanding small Mexican villages. And small Mexican villages is where all Mexican immigration originates. Doesn't originate from the big cities. It is also, by the way, where all drug trafficking originates. It doesn't originate really so much in the big cities, although traffickers may move eventually to the big cities. So my second book was Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream, True Tales of Mexican Migration, and it tells stories of Mexican immigrants, those small villages. It also tells the story of my one a very serious run-in with drug traffickers in Mexico. And that is actually a fairly weird story about the Mennonite communities of Mexico, particularly the very large Mennonite. These are German Mennonites, basically, who live in Mexico. There's a lot of them. People may not know that, but they're very large, pretty large community south of Ciudad Juarez, about 4 hours. And they are that's a community. It looks very pious and humble and religious, and they are very, very deeply involved in drug trafficking. And I went down there to do that story, to do the story about the narco Mennonitas, the narco Mennonites, and eventually got run out of there basically by those same traffickers. And this was in my second book. The book I'm working on now, though, is another book about Mexico. It's about a famed singer, a ballad singer, sang ballads about drug traffickers and guys from these very same small villages that I mentioned. His name is Chalino Sanchez. He himself was murdered in 1992, became a legend. He is kind of, you know, the way that Frank Sinatra became kind of this huge thing to all the Italian mobsters and mafia. Well, he is that to the Mexican cartel and drug trafficking world. Chalino is their Frank Sinatra, although he sings nothing like him. Mm-hmm. He's just a singer that they all want to kind of emulate or love, whose music they love. And his stories, basically his songs are mostly stories about traffickers or how some guy died in a shootout and this kind of thing. And so the ballad of Chalino Sanchez, or the biography of Chalino Sanchez, is the same story as the next book I'm working on. It also involves stories about illegal immigration, because he himself was a smuggler for a while. His brother was a very big time smuggler until he himself was murdered. In fact, murder is the part of the story, a big part of the story. And then the other part of the story is the rise of Mexican drug trafficking and how the Mexicans essentially take the market away from the Colombians in the 1990s and become the enormous and rather and fearsome cartels that they are today. A lot of that has to do with the fact that they basically took over the transporting of drugs from the Colombians. And so the story of Chalino Sanchez is the book I'm working on now. Should be take me a year to write it, I think, and maybe another year to publish it, something like that.
Well, good luck with that, and you'll come on the show, won't you, to talk to us about that?
Oh, that, I'd be very
and
happy.
We can continue to solve the world's problems. We could pretty much wrap that up next time, I bet. Well, anyway, Sam, thank you very much for being on the show. Today we've been talking to Sam Quiñones about his book, Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. I think that anybody, actually anybody, period, should read this book, especially anybody in the United States, but also maybe some people in Mexico. Has it been translated into Spanish?
It's going to be. In the process.
Well, it should be. Yes, absolutely. It should be. Probably translated into a bunch of languages, I hope. But anyway, I want to thank you very much for being on the show. And I want to thank everybody who listens to the New Books Network for tuning in. I guess we don't tune in anymore for downloading or whatever we do. So I'm Marshall Toe, the host of, or the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.